Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Deuteronomy chapter 16. I'm going to cover verses 1 through 22. We will look at the three major feasts in the Jewish calendar, and then we will look at the justice system and laws concerning that. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, Deuteronomy 15, we looked at the sabbatical year and the freeing of slaves after their six-year term, and we looked at some laws concerning firstborn animals, the eating thereof. And so we begin now in Deuteronomy 16, verse 1. Observe the month of Abib and celebrate the Passover to the Lord your God. For in the month of Abib, the Lord your God brought you out of Egypt by night. Now Abib is March and April, or March, April, end of March, beginning of April in the Gregorian calendar. It's Nisan in the Jewish calendar, the Jewish religious calendar, and that's what we're more familiar with. It's the month of the first fruits, because green ears of barley, they were full at that time. They had grown up, ripened. They were offered on the second day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which followed right on the Passover, Nisan the 16th. All right, so Abib, Nisan 14, beginning of Passover, the Passover day is Nisan the 14th, and the beginning of Unleavened Bread is Nisan the 15th, and the second day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread is Nisan the 16th. And that is when the first fruits, first barley fruits, were offered. Jameson Fawcett Brown says of this second day of the Passover, Nisan the 16th, as on the second day of the Passover, a sheaf of new barley, reaped on purpose, was offered. So on the second day of Pentecost, that's 50 days later, a sheaf of new wheat was presented as first fruits. So you had first fruits of barley at Passover, first fruits of wheat at Pentecost. 50 days later. Now, Passover is fully described in Exodus 12 and Exodus 13. I'm not going to go over great details of Passover. We can go back to those chapters if we're interested in doing that. Now, there's an interesting little detail here at the end of verse 1. The Lord God brought you out of Egypt by night. Well, that presents a little problem because the Israelites were forbidden to leave the house at Passover time at night. Exodus 12, 22, second part of the verse. And none of you shall go outside the door of his house until morning. And we find that the Israelites actually left in the morning after Passover in the daytime, not at night. Numbers 33, 3. They journeyed from Ramses in the first month on the 15th day of the first month. That's Nisan the 15th. On the next day after the Passover, Nisan the 15th, the sons of Israel started out boldly in the sight of all the Egyptians. That was not at night. So what does Moses mean here as he gives his speech? And I forgot to mention this is his second discourse to the Israelites on the plains of Moab. His first discourse was inveighing against idolatry, and the second discourse was encouraging the Israelites to keep the law. Now, Moses tells the people, the Lord your God brought you out of Egypt by night. How do we reconcile that with the fact that they left in the daytime? Well, here's Jameson Fawcett and Brown's reconciliation. I think it makes a lot of sense. A lot of things happened at night before the departure. First of all, they had to extort the Pharaoh, let us leave, or we're going to have another plague fall on your head, Pharaoh. And then they had to prepare for the departure. They had to pack up. And this is not just a weekend trip, folks. This was moving all of their possessions into the desert. And then, of course, the smiting of the firstborn went on all during that night. And so Moses makes perfectly good sense here when he says the Lord God brought you out of Egypt by night. The bringing out of Egypt started in the nighttime. It finished in the daytime. Deuteronomy 16, verses 2 through 4. You shall sacrifice the Passover to the Lord your God from the flock and the herd in the place where the Lord chooses to establish his name. That's Jerusalem. You shall not eat leavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat it with unleavened bread, the bread of affliction, for you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, so that you may remember all the days of your life, the day when you came out of the land of Egypt. For 7 days no leaven shall be seen with you in all your territory, and none of the flesh which you sacrifice on the evening of the first day shall remain overnight until morning. Now, a lot of this concerns details of the Passover / Feast of Unleavened Bread, which we've already gone over in Exodus 12. Again, I'm not going to go through a lot of details here. Just make a few comments. You shall sacrifice the Passover from the flock and the herd. Now, actually, there was no oxen killed on Passover. You should sacrifice the Passover from the flock and the herd. The herd is cows. There were no cows sacrificed on Passover, Nisan the 14th, only the Passover lamb. So as John Gill and Jameson Fawcett and Brown say, this must be, has to be, a reference to the oxen that were killed during the 7 days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Remember, Passover is Nisan 14th, and Nisan 15 through 21 followed right on it, 7 days right behind Passover. So altogether, there were 8 days. Some people call the whole 8 days Passover. Some people call the whole 8 days Unleavened Bread, because the two feasts went together. And so when Moses says you shall sacrifice the Passover here, he means Passover plus the Feast of Unleavened Bread, because there were no oxen celebrated on Nisan 14th. Now, at this Passover feast, they're said not to eat leavened bread. Of course, the unleavened status of the bread reflects the fact that the Israelites had to eat in haste, and so they didn't have time to put leaven in their bread because they had to leave in such a hurry, and that's what the symbolism was. The bread is called the bread of affliction, for you came out of the land of Egypt in haste. There's the haste. That has to do with why the bread was unleavened. It's called the bread of affliction because it was unpleasant as they left Egypt. It was not an easy thing to do, the Exodus, the beginning of the Exodus. And that bread itself, baked as it was without leaven, was unsavory, as Adam Clark put it in his English way. The unsavory bread reminded the Israelites of the afflictions in Egypt. The bread was sour, unpleasant, and unwholesome. Well, I've had unleavened bread before. It's not very tasty, but I don't know about sour and unpleasant. He might be exaggerating a little bit. Verse 3, we see Moses saying, remember the days of your life when you came out of the land of Egypt. Remember that you were a slave. He says that over and over again in his speech because he wants the Israelites to contrast the days of their slavery from the days of their freedom and deliverance and liberation from that slavery as they prepare to enter into the promised land. I've got 14 verses in Deuteronomy where Moses tells the people, remember, or God tells the people, remember, and most of it is remember when you were a slave, and then sometimes it's remember some unpleasant things that happened on the Exodus. And it's a good object lesson. We need to remember when we were enslaved to our sin and the terrible things in our life, and God liberated us from that. Just think about that next time you feel bad about life. Deuteronomy 16, verses 5 through 6. You are not allowed to sacrifice the Passover in any of your towns which the Lord your God is giving you. But at the place where the Lord your God chooses to establish his name, you shall sacrifice the Passover in the evening at sunset, at the time that you came out of Egypt. Now, basically, that verse says you don't sacrifice Passover in Galilee or Samaria or in somewhere else in Israel. You go down to Jerusalem to do it. Remember, there were three feasts, and the males of Israel were required to go down to Israel for those three feasts. Now, that's the place that's required. Now, as far as the time is stated to be at the time that you came out of Egypt. So that would be Nisan 14th at the exact time that they came out of Egypt. Well, the problem with that is they didn't come out of Egypt till Nisan. They left on Nisan the 15th, not Nisan the 14th. The NIV note has it translated this way, you shall sacrifice the Passover at sundown at the time of day. Well, that makes it look like the time of the Passover was the exact time of the Passover they had in Egypt. The time of the Passover to be celebrated in Jerusalem was the exact time of the Passover celebrated in Egypt. But I don't think that's what it is. When Moses says you're to sacrifice the Passover at the time that you came out of Egypt, it means the anniversary of the day that you came out of Egypt. The NIV translation has this, when the sun goes down on the anniversary of your departure. So at nightfall on Nisan the 14th, celebrate the Passover. Deuteronomy 16, verses 7 through 8. You shall cook and eat it in the place which the Lord your God chooses. That's Jerusalem. In the morning you are to return to your tents. 6 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a solemn assembly to the Lord your God. You shall do no work on it. Now it says in the morning you are to return to your tents. I'm assuming that's the morning after Passover, the morning of Nisan the 15th, Passover being on the 14th. Now, John Gill suggests that it might be after the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which is Nisan the 21st. And Jameson Fawcett Brown wonders himself whether that might be the case. This is what they say, quote, the sense of this passage on the first glance of the words seems to point to the morning after the first day, the Passover Eve. Perhaps, however, the divinely appointed duration of this feast, the solemn character and important object, the journey of the people from the distant parts of the land to be present, and the recorded examples of their continuing all the time through unleavened bread, which we see in 2 Chronicles 30, verse 21, and 2 Chronicles chapter 35, verse 17. All of this may warrant the conclusion that the leave given to the people to return home was to be on the morning after the completion of the 7 days. I guess his idea is they took all that time getting down there. You're saying they're going to go down there, celebrate one day, and turn around and go back? Nah, they probably stayed down there for 8 days and turned around and went back. There's some logic to that. It's really unclear. But whatever day it was, after the whichever festival it was they were leaving after, either Passover or Unleavened Bread, they went back to their tents. The NIV Study Bible says they went back to wherever they were staying while at the festival, whether in permanent or temporary quarters. Local Jerusalemites, I guess, would be in permanent quarters, and visitors from the other parts of the land would be, I understand that the people had guest rooms and they put up the pilgrims. Now, on the seventh day, that's the seventh day of the Unleavened Bread, the eighth day of Passover / Unleavened Bread, that's Nisan 21st, there shall be a solemn assembly to the Lord your God. Just as it was on 15th, on the 21st, they had a Sabbath. There were Sabbath days bracketed the Festival of Unleavened Bread. This is called a solemn assembly by the New American Standard Bible here. The Hebrew probably does mean solemn assembly. We see the phrase assembly in Leviticus 23:36. For 7 days you shall present an offering by fire to the Lord. On the eighth day you shall have a holy convocation and present an offering by fire to the Lord. It is an assembly. You shall do no laborious work. So the NASB just translates it as assembly instead of solemn assembly. The NIV in Leviticus 23:36 calls it the closing assembly. But anyway, it's a solemn assembly. It's a Sabbath, a festival Sabbath. We go now to Deuteronomy 16, verses 9 through 10. You shall count 7 weeks for yourself. You shall begin to count 7 weeks from the time you begin to put the sickle to the standing grain. Then you shall celebrate the Feast of Weeks to the Lord your God with a tribute of a freewill offering of your hand, which you shall give just as the Lord your God blesses you. Now, these 7 weeks are very famous because from that phrase, 7 weeks, we get the name Feast of Weeks. The Hebrew for weeks is Shavuot, so the Jews call the festival Shavuot. Now, the Feast of Weeks, when you do the counting, I'll show you how you do the counting in just a minute, it ended up on a particular day, Sivan the 6th. And it started on Nisan the 16th, which was the second day of Unleavened Bread. It was the day where the first fruits of the barley harvest were offered. And that's what it means here in verse 9 when it says, from the time you begin to put the sickle to the standing grain, that means the first fruits of the barley harvest, which is Nisan the 16th. So you count from Nisan the 16th to Sivan the 6th, and there's your 50 days. Well, next question is, how do you go from 7 weeks to 50 days? Because 7 weeks is only 49 days. You shall count 7 weeks. How did you end up with 50 days? Well, we go back to Leviticus 23, verses 15 to 16, and we'll see how. Leviticus 23:15, you're to count 7 complete weeks starting from the day after the Sabbath. Now that Sabbath is talking about Nisan 15th, the first Sabbath day of the Festival of Unleavened Bread, the day after Passover. So starting from the day after that Nisan the 15th, that's Nisan the 16th, as I just said, the day you brought the sheaf of the presentation offering, that's the sheaf of the first fruit of the barley harvest. All right, from that day, verse 16, you are to count 50 days until the day after the seventh Sabbath. So there's your 7 weeks, and each week has a Sabbath, so that's 7 Sabbaths. And then the day after the seventh Sabbath, that's the 50th day. And then present an offering of new grain to the Lord. And of course, that new grain after the seventh Sabbath, after the 50th day, is the new grain of wheat, the first fruits of wheat offering at the Feast of Weeks. Now, the Feast of Weeks, by the way, is also called Pentecost because of those 50 days. Pentecost in Greek means 50, or 50th. The Greek word for 50th is Pentecoste. Pretty close, huh? Pentecoste. That's where we get the term Pentecost. But that's a Greek term. The Jews call it the Festival of Harvest, the Feast of Weeks, or the Feast of Harvest, because it was a harvest festival, harvesting of the grain of the wheat. Now, in verse 10, we see a freewill offering is given at the Feast of Weeks. The Israelites were to give a freewill offering just as the Lord their God blessed them. Now, there were a lot of legally prescribed offerings at the Feast of Weeks also, which we can read about in Leviticus. I'll give you a summary from John Gill. There were 2 wave loaves, which were ordered to be brought, loaves baked out of wheat and weighed before the altar, 7 lambs, 1 young bullock, 2 rams for a burnt offering, together with the grain and the drink offerings that were associated with those offerings, the burnt offerings, a male goat for a sin offering, two lambs for a peace offering. It's a lot of offerings, but that wasn't all. You also brought a voluntary contribution. Just as the Lord has blessed you, so no fixed rate was given, this was a voluntary contribution. You didn't have to give it if you didn't want to, and you could give just as much as you wanted to. Well, let me back up a minute. I'm not so sure you can say it's a free will offering so I can give zero. No, you're supposed to give a free will offering of something, but just the size of it was proportionate to as how God had blessed you. Probably went too far with that. All right, let's go now to Deuteronomy 16, verses 11 and 12. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your son and your daughter and your male and female servants, and the Levite who is in your town, and the stranger and the orphan and the widow who are in your midst, in the place where the Lord your God chooses to establish his name, Jerusalem. Jerusalem's not in the text, I'm just adding that. You shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and you shall be careful to observe these statutes. Now, verse 11 says, you shall rejoice. Notice that these feasts were feast. What is a festival? It's a place where you're happy. It's a place where you're feast. It's a joyous occasion. John Gill says that this joy was communicated to friends with liberality as people were giving free will offerings. The poor were invited to these feasts, and there was great generosity for the poor because the poor got to eat at these feasts. Notice how Moses is careful to include people who might not be invited to feast, the male and female slaves, the Levites, who, as Colin Dillich puts it, are portionless. They have no land. The stranger, the alien, the orphan, the widow, people who might be left out of feasts, but they were specifically included because they were going to have a good time. At least three times a year, they were going to eat to their fill. Verse 12, Moses says, remember when you were a slave. He does that constantly. That remembrance of their slavery would be to better contrast the joy of the feast. That bitter memory might be juxtaposed with the joy that they're having at these feasts, all of which, of course, are typological. Passover, that's the Passover lamb sacrifice for our sins. Harvest, there's a harvest of people coming into the kingdom. Same thing with the Feast of Booths. That's another harvest festival. And, of course, the Feast of Weeks is associated with Pentecost. I mean, we even call it Pentecost, the falling of the Holy Spirit. All of these events are occasions of joy, to rejoice. And I'll tell you, that's something that is really worth remembering when things aren't going well. Things are always bad in this world, but God never tells people, oh, you got to sit around and be miserable because of the state of the world. I have a big problem with this because I spend a lot of my time being miserable over the state of the world because I care about it, and I have since I was 6 years old. But it's been real hard for me to learn to practice rejoicing in the midst of the suffering of the world. And these feasts tell the Israelites, they were to rejoice, not sit around and mope because of COVID-19 and because we got lunatics in the American government who allow American missionaries to get slaughtered in Afghanistan because of their stupidity. Not because of the missionary's stupidity, because of the government stupidity. There's a lot to be upset about, but we're supposed to rejoice before the Lord your God. Verse 12 says, you shall be careful, Moses tells the people, to observe these statutes. And, of course, the statutes he's referring to is the statutes concerning the three major feasts, Passover, Feast of Unleavened Bread, Passover / Feast of Unleavened Bread, Pentecost, and Booths, which are coming up. Deuteronomy 16, verses 13 through 15. You are to celebrate the festival of Booths for 7 days when you have gathered in everything from your threshing floor and winepress. Rejoice during your festival, you, your son and daughter, your male and female slave, as well as the Levite, the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow within your gates. Again, people who are not normally or who might be overlooked at feast time, they're all included. And Moses makes the point to mention it with the Festival of Booths, just like he mentions it with the Festival of Weeks. Verse 15, Deuteronomy 16, you're to hold a 7-day festival for the Lord your God in the place he chooses, because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and all the work of your hands, and you will have abundant joy. Now, this is the famous Festival of Booths, sometimes called the Festival of Tabernacles, depending on how you want to translate it. The Festival of Booths began on Tishri the 15th. We know that because Leviticus 23:34 says this, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, on the 15th of the 7th month is the Feast of Booths. Tishri is the 7th month. Numbers 29:12, you are to hold a sacred assembly on the 15th day of the 7th month. You are to celebrate a 7-day festival for the Lord. Tishri, by the way, is September / October in the Gregorian calendar. Now let's return to this theme of joy at a festival. After all, it's a festival, and festivals is where you have joy, you feast, you have a good time. God says you will have abundant joy, and he mentions abundant joy in connection with all the blessings that God is going to produce for them and all the work of their hands. He's going to bless them. Nothing wrong with rejoicing over a good year if you have a business or if you get a raise or what. Nothing wrong with that. Rejoice in it. You also need to learn to go without, too, because that'll happen, as happened to Paul. He rejoiced when he had abundance, and he rejoiced when he didn't have a lot. But at any rate, this joy, again, is something to really think about in times of sadness. John 3:29, he who has the bride is the bridegroom, but the friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly because the bridegroom's voice. Friend of the bridegroom, of course, is John the Baptist. The bridegroom is Jesus. The bride is the church. So this joy of mine has been made full. John the Baptist is saying, hey, man, I'm full of joy because of Jesus. John 15:11, these things I have spoken to you so that my joy, this is Jesus speaking, these things I have spoken to you so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be full. Jesus promised us joy. That's more than happiness. That is supreme happiness. He promised us that in the midst of all the afflictions of this world. John 16:24, until now you have asked for nothing in my name. Ask and you will receive so that your joy may be made full, complete, complete joy. Philippians 2:2, make my joy complete, Paul says, by being of the same mind, maintaining the same love, united in spirit, intent on one purpose. Oh, there's nothing better than joy. I'm telling you, 1 John 1:4, these things we write so that our joy may be made complete. 2 John 1:12, though I have many things to write to you, I do not want to do so with paper and ink, but I hope to come to you and speak face to face so that your joy may be made full, complete joy. Good verses to meditate upon. Deuteronomy 16:16-17. 3 times in a year all your males shall appear before the Lord your God in the place which he chooses. That's Jerusalem. At the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and at the Feast of Weeks, and at the Feast of Booths. They're your 3 major feasts of Israel. And they shall not appear before the Lord empty-handed. Every man shall give as he is able, according to the blessing of the Lord your God, which he has given you. Now this 3 times a year coming to Israel was repeated several times in the law. Exodus 23:14, 3 times a year you shall celebrate a feast to me. Exodus 23:17, 3 times a year all your males shall appear before the Lord God. Exodus 34:23, 3 times a year all your males are to appear before the Lord God. So this was a strong command. Notice it's males that are required to go to Jerusalem. The women were not required to go to Jerusalem. They could optionally go. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says the reason they were not required to go because of their domestic duties and because of the weakness of their sex. Ooh. Apparently Jameson Fawcett and Brown was not acquainted with all the feminist wisdom we have today. He doesn't realize that women traveling on a road down to Jerusalem could take care of wild beasts and lions just as well as the men could, and robbers and brigands who might attack them. She could take a knife in the gut for her husband just as the husband could do for her, because there's no difference between men and women. What is the matter with these antiquated commentators like Jameson Fawcett and Brown talking about the weakness of the female sex? But at any rate, they didn't have to go, but the men did. Now in verse 17, free will offerings are mentioned. Every man shall give as he is able, according to the blessing of the Lord your God. That's just, the NIV translates as in proportion to the blessing of the Lord your God, just as the Lord your God has given you. There's various ways to translate it, but again, it's the idea of proportional giving. God gives you more, you give more. If you get less, you give less. Don't make a law about it. It's free will. I mentioned that free will in contrast to the law of the tithe, which so many Christians seem to be hung up on, preaching the so-called storehouse doctrine like it was a command from God written in stone, as if the Christians of the New Covenant were still under the Old Covenant. But anyway, I digress. Here's some scriptures talking about proportional giving. Deuteronomy 16:10, then you shall celebrate the Feast of Weeks to the Lord your God with a tribute of a freewill offering of your hand, which you shall give just as the Lord your God blesses you. I've already talked about it in this verse just a few verses ago, and that's the Feast of Weeks. You had proportional giving. And here at the Feast of Booths, you have proportional giving, free will giving. So apparently both at The Passover and the Feast of Weeks and the Feast of Booths all had freewill offerings, because you could always offer a freewill offering. It's a type of a peace offering. And apparently this was enjoined upon the Israelites. This idea is in the New Testament, 2 Corinthians 8:12, for if the readiness is present, it is acceptable according to what a person has, not according to what he does not have. In other words, the focus is not on the amount, but on the heart. We go now to Deuteronomy 16, verses 18 through 20. You shall appoint for yourself judges and officers in all your towns which the Lord your God is giving you, according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not distort justice, you shall not be partial, and you shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. Justice, and only justice, you shall pursue, that you may live and possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you. Now we move from the topic of festivals to the legal system. Moses has already talked a lot about the legal system in his first discourse to the Israelites on the plains of Moab, Deuteronomy 1, 9 through 18. He brings it up again, and I speculate it's because Moses was in charge of that legal system. He was a lawgiver, as a matter of fact, and so that's why he's really emphasizing it. But it's interesting to me, once the legal system gets corrupt, there is nothing that anybody can do. There is no justice. There's nothing but raw, naked power. There's nothing more important than getting rid of bribes and partiality and corruption out of the legal system. I remember talking to a man who was reputed to be the most successful lawyer in Shanghai, which is a huge Chinese city, over 20-something million people in it. And he quit the practice of law in order to get a PhD at my university. And so I was eating with him and asked him, why in the world did you quit such a successful practice? He says, because I'm not really practicing law. All I do is go schmooze the judges and offer them bribes. Well, they don't call it bribes in China. It's guanxi, you know, gifts. Well, it's bribes is what it is. And he got tired of it. Well, let's look at what Moses said in Deuteronomy 1, 9 through 18 about the justice system in Israel. I spoke to you at that time saying, I'm not able to bear the burden of you alone. Now, he's referring back to when he was doing all the law cases by himself and he had to parcel out the job to subordinate judges at the behest of his father-in-law, Jethro. Verse 10, Deuteronomy 1, the Lord your God has multiplied you, and behold, you are this day like the stars of heaven in number. May the Lord, the God of your fathers, increase you 1,000-fold more than you are and bless you. He mentions the number of the Israelites there. And then in verse 12, he says, how can I alone bear the load and burden of you and your strife? And there's so many of you, and you're fighting all the time. Verse 13, choose wise and discerning and experienced men from your tribes, and I will appoint them as your heads. You answered me and said, the thing which you have said to do is good. So I took the heads of your tribes, wise and experienced men, and appointed them heads over you, leaders of thousands and of hundreds, of fifties and of tens, and officers for your tribes. Then I charged your judges at that time, saying, hear the cases between your fellow countrymen, and judge righteously between a man and his fellow countrymen, or the alien who is with him. You shall not show partiality in judgment. There's that idea, no bribes. You shall hear the small and the great alike. You shall not fear man, for the judgment is God's. The case that is too hard for you, you shall bring to me, and I will hear it. So Moses was the Supreme Court judge. Justice, I commanded you at that time all the things that you should do. Now, that which Moses says that he carried out was done at the behest of his father-in-law Jethro. We read that in Exodus 18, verses 13 through 26. It came about the next day that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood about Moses from the morning until evening. That's what he was doing, all day long, judging people, handling law cases. Now, when Moses' father-in-law, that's Jethro, saw all that he was doing for the people, he said, what is this thing that you're doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge and all the people stand about you from morning until evening? Moses said to his father-in-law, because the people came to me to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, it comes to me, and I judge between a man and his neighbor and make known the statute of God and his laws. It's a nice, pious, holy answer. Moses' father-in-law said to him, the thing that you're doing is not good. I just love that. Oh, I'm doing this thing for God. Moses says, I'm telling the people God and his laws. And Jethro looks at him and says, nah, that's no good. It's hard to answer a super spiritual answer. It really is. But Jethro did. Verse 18, you will surely wear out both yourself and this and these people who are with you, for the task is too heavy for you. You cannot do it alone. Now listen to me. This is Jethro saying, I will give you counseling. God be with you. You be the people's representative before God, and you bring the disputes to God, then teach them the statutes and the laws and make known to them the way in which they are to walk and the work they are to do. That's fine. Furthermore, you shall select out of all the people able men who fear God, men of truth, those who hate dishonest gain, and you shall place these over them as leaders of thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Let them judge the people at all times, and let it be that every major dispute they will bring to you, but every minor dispute they themselves will judge. Good old Jethro, common sense. He was Moses' father-in-law, by the way. Zipporah's daughter had married Moses back when Moses was in Midian, running from the Pharaoh's capital. So it will be easier for you, continues Jethro, and they will bear the burden with you, these subordinate judges. If you do this thing, and God so commands you, then you will be able to endure, and all these people also will go to their place in peace. So Moses listened to his father-in-law and did all that he had said. And it goes on to say Moses chose all the subordinate justices. So that's the story of the legal system. This idea that you should not be partial is stated. Well, actually, the idea of not taking a bribe, let's talk about that one first. Exodus 23:8, you shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of the just. That's in another place in Exodus 23. Now, how could a judge be partial? He's told the Jewish judges are told not to be partial in verse 19 of Deuteronomy 16, where we are now. Here are some ways that they could be partial. They could favor the rich over the poor, or they could favor the poor over the rich. Maybe you got a bleeding heart judge or something, I don't know. Or it could be the judges are related to the litigants, and so the judge would favor his relative over his non-relative. It could be the judge is friends with the litigant, so he favors his friend over somebody who is not his friend. Or it could be the judges have been bribed by the litigants, which is the worst way of being partial. Now in verse 20, Moses tells the people, justice and only justice you shall pursue that you may live and possess the land. He's saying, hey, you want to live, you want to possess the land, do justice. And the implication is if you don't do justice, you're going to die and you're not going to possess the land. Now, how important is justice? We go now to Deuteronomy 16, verses 21 through 22, and we will finish this audio. You shall not plant for yourself an Asherah of any kind of tree beside the altar of the Lord your God, which you shall make for yourself. You shall not set up for yourself a sacred pillar, which the Lord your God hates. Now, this is a change of subject here. A little couple verses at the end of the chapter against idolatry. He's already mentioned this, by the way, in another place. What is an Asherah? An NIV. The NIV translates Asherah as a wooden Asherah pole. Asherah is the name of Astarte, the Canaanite goddess of fertility named Ishtar in Assyria. She was all over the ancient Near East. She was in Egypt too, I think named Isis. I can't remember the Egyptian name, but it's the same goddess, the many-breasted goddess of fertility, the goddess whom the people would honor with painted eggs, from which we get our Easter eggs as we celebrate. I thought it was supposed to be the resurrection of Jesus, but apparently it's Astarte. And the people would put poles. They would strip tree limbs off of trees and just stick a pole up there and dedicate that to Asherah or Astarte. The NIV note here has, do not plant any tree dedicated to Asherah. Instead of an Asherah pole, it was any kind of tree dedicated to Asherah. The KJV, by the way, has grove instead of trees. Tree, which is confusing to me. All the modern translations have tree, not grove. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Deuteronomy 16, and now we are ready to go into our next chapter, Deuteronomy 17, verses 1 through 20. We will look further at Israel's justice system, taking up where we left off here in chapter 16, and then we will look at laws concerning Israel's kings, which they weren't supposed to have, but they ended up with. So we'll do that next time. Hope you stay tuned for that, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.